Lincoln, Disc 8.
His discouragement was greater because the Taylor administration, which assumed office in March 1849, failed to use the patronage to cement the bonds of Whig party unity. Throughout the country, Whigs assumed that Taylor's victory meant that Democratic officeholders would be removed and replaced by the party faithful. And Lincoln, like every other Whig congressman, was besieged by applications from hungry constituents. Everybody, it seemed, wanted an appointment. As Register of the Land Office in Vandalia, United States Attorney, Secretary to the Governor of the Territory of Minnesota, United States Marshal for the District of Illinois, Purser in the United States Navy, Postmaster in Springfield, Pension Agent, and so on. Conscious that every applicant who didn't receive a job was potentially a political enemy, Lincoln took great pains to give encouragement without building false hopes. "I shall lay your letter by," he told an early applicant, "and if the disposition of these offices falls into my hands, in whole or in part, you shall have a fair hearing." To another he wrote frankly, "Two others, both good men, have applied for the same office before. I've made no pledge, but if the matter falls into my hands, I shall, when the time comes, try to do right in view of all the lights then before me." Still another gained assurance that his application would receive that consideration which is due to impartiality, fairness, and friendship. In making recommendations to the incoming administration, Lincoln made it clear that he thought the spoils of office ought to be used to strengthen the Whig Party. Recognizing that President Taylor was disinclined to make wholesale removals of Democratic incumbents, Lincoln insisted that when an office or a job isn't already in Democratic hands, that it should be given to a Whig. Otherwise, he warned, "I verily believe the administration can't be sustained." Whenever he learned that a Democratic appointee was strongly partisan, he favored replacing him with a Whig. For instance, in supporting the candidacy of Walter Davis to be receiver of the land office in Springfield, Lincoln wrote candidly to the Secretary of the Interior that the present incumbent had adequately discharged the duties of that office, but, he added, "he is a very warm partisan and openly and actively opposed the election of General Taylor." The Whigs here almost universally desire his removal. Similarly, in asking that his old friend A.Y. Ellis be appointed postmaster of Springfield, he wrote, "J.R. Diller, the present incumbent, I cannot say has failed in the proper discharge of any of the duties of the office. He, however, has been an active partisan in opposition to us, and he's been a member of the Democratic State Central Committee." Several of the applicants that Lincoln recommended for minor jobs did receive appointments, but he found the whole process frustrating and unsatisfactory. A lame duck congressman, about to be succeeded by a Democrat, he didn't have much influence with the Taylor administration. He was obliged to share control over the Illinois patronage with Baker, elected as a Whig representative in the next Congress, and inevitably there was a certain amount of friction. No one in Washington seemed to be listening to Lincoln's requests or to acknowledge that his exertions in behalf of the Taylor campaign entitled him to special consideration. By the beginning of May, he lamented, "Not one man recommended by me has yet been appointed to anything, little or big, except a few who had no opposition." At the outset of Taylor's administration, Lincoln himself was not an office seeker, but supported Baker's claim for a place in the cabinet or a foreign mission. At Lincoln's urging, Speed appealed to the influential John J. Crittenden on his friend's behalf. But the Kentucky governor had no favorable impression of Baker. "There is Lincoln," Crittenden said, "whom I regard as a rising man. If he were an applicant, I'd go for him." But the flattery didn't turn Lincoln's head. "There's nothing about me which would authorize me to think of a first-class office," he told Speed, "and a second-class one wouldn't compensate me for being snarled at by others who want it for themselves." Shortly afterward, he was ensnared in the very trap that he was trying to avoid. It became clear that the highest appointment to be given to any Illinois Whig would be that of Commissioner of the General Land Office, a position that not merely paid the handsome salary of $3,000 a year, but carried with it a great deal of power and some patronage. The commissioner was in general charge of all the public lands. His decisions determined how and when the lands were sold. He could do much to encourage the settlement of the West, and, since he controlled the sale of public lands to the state governments, he could promote the building of railroads and other internal improvements. Westerners thought it important to have the office filled by someone who knew Western laws and understood the needs of Western farmers and railroad developers. Illinois Whigs saw in the appointment a way of strengthening their party. Some of Lincoln's friends urged him to apply for the post. It would be better than returning to his law practice, which, Judge David Davis warned, at present promises you but poor remuneration for the labor. "Were I in your place," Davis suggested, "could I get it, I'd take the land office." The judge might also have mentioned that this needn't be a dead-end job, instancing that James Shields, Lincoln's old enemy, had held the office under President Polk, only to go on to election as senator from Illinois. But Lincoln's interest was, at most, tepid. He was confident that, almost by common consent, the Whigs in Congress would support his candidacy, and he knew the job would pay him more than he could otherwise make. But he was reluctant to make a final surrender of the law as a career. Anyway, well before Taylor's inauguration, he'd promised to give his support to Cyrus Edwards, a former Whig legislator and unsuccessful Whig candidate for governor, who was a relative of his brother-in-law, Ninian W. Edwards. But Edwards, it turned out, couldn't get the job because Baker disliked him and favored another candidate, James L. D. Morrison. As letters supporting both Edwards and Morrison piled up on the desk of Secretary of the Interior Thomas Ewing, there was a stalemate, and it seemed likely that Illinois might not receive the land commissioner's appointment after all. At this point, Lincoln's friends insisted that he must seek the position himself. He continued to hesitate, because he and Baker had agreed that if either Morrison or Edwards could be persuaded to withdraw, they'd support the other. "In relation to these pledges," Lincoln told his supporters, "I must not only be chaste, but above suspicion." He could take the appointment only if both Edwards and Morrison declined it. In April, a new candidate appeared on the scene. Whigs in the rapidly growing northern section of Illinois felt that all appointments were going to the central and southern counties. "Mr. Lincoln," one of them grumbled, "can see nothing north of Springfield and Jacksonville in a favorable light." They were joined by E.B. Washburn and his Galena friends, eager to cut down Baker's influence. Jointly, they came up with the name of Justin Butterfield, a distinguished Whig lawyer of Chicago, who'd served as United States attorney under Harrison and Tyler. Butterfield had the endorsement of both Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, and Secretary Ewing considered him the most profound lawyer in the state, especially as a land lawyer. The news of Butterfield's candidacy aroused Lincoln. "He's my personal friend and is qualified to do the duties of the office," he admitted. "But of the quite 100 Illinoisans equally well qualified, I don't know one with less claims to it." Butterfield had supported Clay, not Taylor, for the 1848 nomination, and had hardly lifted a finger for the president's election. His appointment would be an egregious political blunder, which would gratify no single Whig in the state except it be Mr. B. himself. Lincoln resolved to enter the field himself, and he began soliciting letters of support from leading Illinois Whigs and from congressmen he'd known in Washington. In order to blanket the country, he even enlisted Mary to write letters. His campaign was strong enough to persuade the president to delay the appointment for 3 weeks, so that both Butterfield and Lincoln could rush to Washington and present their cases in person. Favoring Butterfield from the start, Secretary Ewing was impressed by the endorsements he gathered, including an anti-Lincoln petition signed by disgruntled Whigs from Springfield itself, who declared they were dissatisfied with the course of Abraham Lincoln as a member of Congress from this congressional district. One of them followed up with a letter declaring that Lincoln's stand on the Mexican War had rendered him very unpopular and inflicted a deep and mischievous wound upon the whole Whig party of the state. In the end, Taylor followed his standard practice of allowing each cabinet member to make the appointments in his department and gave the office to Butterfield. Fuming, Lincoln declared that the president was getting the unjust and ruinous character of being a mere man of straw. Lincoln was disappointed, not so much for himself as for the Whig party. "I opposed the appointment of Mr. B. because I believed it would be a matter of discouragement to our active, working friends here, and I opposed it for no other reason," he wrote Ewing. "I never did, in any true sense, want the office myself." In his view, Butterfield belonged to the old fossil wing of the party, content to live on occasional federal appointments without ever building a strong state organization. Lincoln saw the land commissioner's appointment as a means of building a viable Whig party in Illinois, which had never won in a presidential election or in a gubernatorial race. Properly used, that office could supplement the active local organizations that Lincoln had encouraged and the convention system that he'd helped to establish. At the end of his congressional career, Lincoln returned to private life, discouraged about the prospects of his party. It didn't relieve his gloom when Secretary of State John M. Clayton offered him, as a consolation prize, the office of Secretary to the Governor of the Oregon Territory, which he promptly declined. Then Interior Secretary Ewing, realizing the snub they'd given to the most active Illinois Whig, tendered him the governorship of the Oregon Territory. Lincoln briefly toyed with the possibility, but quickly concluded that it led nowhere. Oregon was strongly Democratic, and once it was admitted to the Union, it would hardly choose a Whig like Lincoln as governor or senator. Anyway, moving to the West Coast would be difficult and dangerous, especially because Eddie's health was uncertain. He declined the offer, putting the blame, as husbands so often do, on his wife, who, he said, put her foot down about moving. With that, his public career was apparently over. As he settled back in Springfield, he must have remembered a note he gave a few months earlier to an autograph collector who requested his signature with a sentiment. "I'm not a very sentimental man, and the best sentiment I can think of is that if you collect the signatures of all persons who are no less distinguished than I, you'll have a very undistinguishing mass of names." Chapter 6. At the Head of His Profession in This State. From 1849 to 1854, both inclusive, I practiced law more assiduously than ever before, Lincoln wrote in an 1859 autobiographical sketch. This was a time for redirecting his career. He needed first to resettle his family after his sojourn in Washington, and the Lincolns moved back into their little house on 8th and Jackson Streets in Springfield. Next, he had to resume his law career, his sole source of income, now that he was no longer receiving a government salary. He turned down the tempting offer of Grant Goodrich to join his Chicago law firm, saying that if he moved to the city, he'd have to sit down and study hard, and it'd kill him, because he tended to consumption. Instead, he and Herndon continued their partnership. Political prospects played little part in these decisions. As he noted in an 1860 biography, his profession had almost superseded the thought of politics in his mind. Illinois offered no future for an ambitious Whig politician. He recognized that his public career was at an end. In these years of relative tranquility, Lincoln had time for self-examination. His years in Washington did nothing to undermine his supreme self-confidence, but he couldn't help observing that he had less education and professional training than most of his fellow congressmen. In a brief autobiography prepared for a congressional biographical directory, he commented tersely, "Education defective." He began, as Herndon said, to realize a certain lack of discipline, a want of mental training and method. Believing, as did most of his contemporaries, that mental faculties, like muscles, could be strengthened by rigorous exercise, he secured a copy of Euclid's Principles of Geometry, and with determination set himself to working out the theorems and problems. With quiet pride, he reported in 1860 that he had studied and nearly mastered the 6 books of Euclid. Though some of his clients had drifted away during his term in Congress, it didn't take long for Lincoln to reestablish his position at the bar. He retained some clients whose cases had begun before his election to Congress and were still pending. For instance, he continued to be involved in the never-ending litigation of Nancy Robinson Dorman to recover land in Gallatin County, wrongfully diverted by her stepfather. After becoming Dorman's attorney in 1842, Lincoln kept an interest in her suit while in Congress and finally succeeded in winning a judgment in her favor in 1852. He had little difficulty in attracting new clients because people remembered his enviable record of success in the courts before his election. Doubtless, his reputation got a boost when he was admitted to practice before the United States Supreme Court in 1849, where he effectively argued a case. After his return to Springfield, he developed a sizable practice before the Illinois Supreme Court. Some of his early cases were trivial. For example, in 1851 he was asked to appear in the case of one Robert Knuckles, who was suing for damage Elijah Bacon's cattle did to his corn. Not satisfied with the $2.50 awarded him by the local justice of the peace, Knuckles employed a local attorney to sue Bacon in the Macon County Circuit Court. This time, a jury awarded him damages in the amount of $3.33. Unhappy with the verdict, Bacon wanted his lawyer to engage Lincoln's services for an appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court. But soon, Lincoln was involved in more important litigation, such as the suit of Oliver W. Browning, who fell and broke his leg on an unrepaired street in Springfield and sued the city for failing to maintain its roads. The common law provided no remedy for Browning, but Lincoln argued that the city charter required Springfield to keep its streets in repair. Adopting Lincoln's arguments, the Supreme Court ruled for Browning, establishing an often-cited precedent in municipal law. In these Supreme Court cases, Lincoln and Herndon worked as a team. An omnivorous and rapid reader, Herndon made it his job in each case to go through all the relevant decisions he could locate in the well-stocked state library and the Supreme Court library, which had the reports of all the state Supreme Courts and the federal courts, as well as the usual legal reference works and dictionaries. Because so many of the subjects of litigation were repetitious, he compiled a kind of legal index in a large commonplace book, where he recorded precedents he discovered on a wide variety of topics, from streets and improvements, a subject directly relevant to the Browning case, and negligence in building bridges, to larger subjects such as corrupt motives, physical or moral nuisances, trusts, and specific performances. As Lincoln and Herndon came more and more to deal with business firms, the junior partner prepared a separate, smaller notebook he entitled Corporations, where he listed precedents on topics like organization, subscription, forfeiture of stock, and forfeiture of charter. In addition, he drew up briefs for many individual cases, outlining the principal issues and precedents. For his part, Lincoln did virtually all the paperwork involved in these Supreme Court cases, preparing even the most formal and routine documents in his own hand. Because Herndon, in 1848, began serving as deputy clerk of court, he wasn't free to make frequent appearances before that bench, and Lincoln usually appeared alone or with some other attorney. But both partners recognized the contribution that Herndon's research made to Lincoln's courtroom victories, and they continued to divide the fees from these cases equally. Lincoln and Herndon also developed a thriving practice before the United States Circuit and District Courts in Illinois, which handled suits between citizens of different states, suits brought by the United States government, and other miscellaneous types of cases. Admitted to practice before the United States Courts in 1839, Lincoln had appeared in at least 62 cases before he left for Congress, and on his return, he naturally sought to pick up additional business in the federal courts, where cases were likely to involve larger questions and greater fees than the purely local litigation of the state courts. Because the court system had changed somewhat during his absence, he found abundant opportunity. The growth of Chicago made it imperative to hold sessions of the federal courts there as well as in Springfield. And Congress, in 1855, divided the state into two judicial districts, with Judge Thomas Drummond presiding in Chicago and Judge Samuel H. Treat in Springfield. This multiplication of jurisdictions was a boon to lawyers, and Lincoln was soon making fairly regular appearances in the United States courts in Chicago as well as in Springfield. In the federal courts, Lincoln handled almost every kind of proceeding, including, improbably enough, a case in Admiralty involving a salvage operation on a ferry boat in the Mississippi River. Much of his time was taken by suits for debt brought against citizens of Illinois by plaintiffs residing in other states. In 17 cases, he represented Samuel C. Davis and Company, a wholesale firm in St. Louis, which sued to collect unpaid bills in Illinois. This wasn't work that Lincoln enjoyed, nor was it remunerative, because he had to hire a man to visit each of the localities where a debtor lived and appraise his property in order to determine whether a court decree could be executed. As other more interesting and rewarding cases came his way, he resolved to drop Davis and Company as a client, and he wrote the firm, "My mind is made up. I'll have no more to do with this class of business. I can do business in court, but I cannot and will not follow executions all over the world." Other litigation in the federal courts he continued to find fascinating, especially when it involved mechanical devices and patents. His very first case in the Chicago federal court, Z. Parker versus Charles Hoyt, had to do with Hoyt's alleged infringement of Parker's patent for a water wheel. Along with Grant Goodrich, Lincoln represented Hoyt. Defending their client with great energy, Lincoln explained to the jury in clear, simple language that Hoyt's device was not a copy of Parker's patented water wheel, but was simply an application of an age-old principle of water power. He reinforced his point by describing his early experience as an operator of Offutt's sawmill at New Salem, which had been powered by the Sangamon River. When the jury came in with a verdict for the defendant, Lincoln said he regarded this as one of the most gratifying triumphs of his professional life. The heart of Lincoln's law practice continued to be in the circuit courts, and Lincoln and Herndon did its largest business in the Sangamon County Circuit Court. In August 1849, at the first session of that court held after Lincoln's return from Congress, the firm had 3 cases on the opening day, 17 cases on the second day, and 8 on the third day. Once again, Lincoln and Herndon was back in business. In 1850, the partners were involved in 18% of all the cases brought before the Sangamon County Circuit Court, and by 1853, they participated in about 1/3 of all cases. As business increased, the small back room in the Tinsley Building, to which Herndon had moved during Lincoln's absence, proved inadequate, and the partners rented a larger second-floor office on the west side of the Capitol Square. It was a bare, unpretentious room with 2 dirty windows looking out over sheds and an alley. There was no carpet. 1 long table occupied the center of the room, with a shorter one crossing it to form a T, and both were covered with green baize. An old-fashioned secretary, with pigeonholes and a drawer to hold legal papers, a bookcase containing about 200 law books, a couch, and some miscellaneous chairs completed the furnishings. The office was almost never cleaned. In this office, the partners worked until 1861. Unless they were on the circuit, both came in every morning, and they sat facing each other at opposite ends of the shorter table. From time to time, Lincoln would throw himself on the couch, resting his legs on 2 or 3 chairs or up against the wall, spilling himself out, as Herndon noted with irritable exaggeration, easily over 1/4 of the room. Often, to his partner's exasperation, Lincoln would read aloud from the daily newspapers or whatever book he was interested in. As he explained to Herndon, When I read aloud, my two senses catch the idea. First, I see what I am reading, and secondly, I hear it read. Then I can thus remember what I read the better. On many cases, the partners work together, with Herndon doing the research and the bookwork, while Lincoln dealt with clients and the courts. But both Lincoln and Herndon handled many cases independently or with other attorneys. In a rough division of labor, Herndon managed the office, insofar as any management was performed, and supervised the one or two students who were reading law with the firm, while Lincoln more often appeared in court. Except when he handled cases in Menard County, Herndon usually stayed in Springfield, while Lincoln went out on the circuit. Every spring, after the adjournment of the Sangamon County Circuit Court, Lincoln set out on the round of the other circuit courts in the 8th Judicial District. He discovered that there'd been some significant changes during his 2-year absence. For one thing, Lincoln now found himself one of the senior lawyers traveling the circuit. Though he was only 40 years old, he was more and more frequently called, though never to his face, Old Abe, both because of his weather-beaten appearance and because of his many years in public life and at the bar. Some of the younger, ambitious lawyers thought of him as one of the fossils who wanted to keep down new talent. And Lincoln himself, while denying any desire to discriminate against younger attorneys, conceded, "I suppose I'm now one of the old men." Another change resulted from the election of 1848 of David Davis as judge of the 8th Judicial District, to succeed Samuel H. Treat, who'd presided over so many of Lincoln's earlier cases on the circuit. Davis, a native of Maryland, educated at Kenyon College and the Yale Law School, had known Lincoln casually for a number of years, but the two men now became closely acquainted in traveling the interminable miles of the circuit and in sitting for endless hours in the county courts. In appearance, they were a curiously mismatched pair. Davis, so portly that it was said he had to be surveyed for a pair of trousers, was a stickler for immaculate clothing and perfect grooming. Lincoln, thin to the point of emaciation, seemed always to be hastily dressed, usually in a bob-tailed sack coat and jeans that didn't come within inches of his feet. In the winter months, he added to this ensemble a circular blue cape, or sometimes a gray shawl, which he wore over his shoulders, fastened with an immense safety pin. In the summer, he traveled in a white linen duster, much stained and the worse for wear. But in many ways, Lincoln and Davis were much alike. Both were devoted Whigs, dedicated to promoting the country's economic growth and national spirit. Border state men, they detested slavery, but deplored abolitionist efforts to end it. In legal matters, Davis, despite his formal training, was neither particularly acute nor learned, and, like Lincoln, he took a commonsensical approach to the law, allowing principles to guide his decisions more often than precedents. Davis and Lincoln didn't become intimate friends. "Lincoln never confided to me anything," Davis remarked many years later, adding that Mr. Lincoln wasn't a sociable man by any means, and that he had no strong emotional feelings for any person, mankind, or thing. That sour judgment derived from the essentially professional nature of their relationship, which was based on respect rather than affection. Each man developed a high opinion of the other's ability. Davis, as he wrote to his wife, greatly admired Mr. Lincoln's exceeding honesty and fairness. So great was the judge's confidence in Lincoln that on numerous occasions, when called away from the bench by family illness or other emergencies, he designated Lincoln to preside in his stead. The practice of asking a prominent attorney to substitute for the judge was a fairly common one on the frontier, until the Illinois Supreme Court put an end to it in 1877. But only when the substitute was an attorney like Lincoln, who had the respect of the other members of the bar, were his rulings accepted without protest. Most of the decisions that Lincoln made as judge were in routine or uncontested cases. But he also disposed of slander suits, divorces, and actions for debt. For the next 11 years, Davis and Lincoln, together with the other lawyers, traveled essentially the same circuit twice a year. In the spring, after concluding the session of the Sangamon County Circuit Court in Springfield, the judge and his entourage moved on to Tremont in Tazewell County, then to Metamora in Woodford County, thence south to Bloomington in McLean County, to Mount Pulaski in Logan County, next east to Clinton in DeWitt County, Monticello in Piatt County, Urbana and Champaign County, and Danville in Vermilion County. After that, south to Paris in Edgar County, then turning west to Shelbyville in Shelby County, Sullivan in Moultrie County, Decatur in Macon County, and Taylorville in Christian County. After that, the judge went back to his home in Bloomington, and the lawyers dispersed. The route varied slightly from year to year, depending in part on the condition of the roads. Sometimes counties where there was little litigation could be skipped. From time to time, the legislature changed the boundaries of the 8th Judicial District, adding or subtracting counties. The area traveled, as Davis grumbled, was equal to the entire state of Connecticut. Roads were slightly better than they had been in the earlier days. Lincoln never used the public stagecoaches that connected a few towns, but traveled in his buggy pulled by Old Buck, the successor to Old Tom. Accommodations remained miserable. Davis's letters to his wife recited a litany of complaints. There was mud in the winter and dust in the summer. Taverns were overrun with mosquitoes, fleas, and bedbugs. The dining rooms were dirty, and typically the table was greasy, the tablecloth greasy, floor greasy, and everything else ditto. The waitress was so filthy that he guessed the dirt must be half an inch thick all over her. Worst of all was the food, hardly fit for the stomach of a horse. Lincoln, as always indifferent to his surroundings and careless of comfort, registered no complaints. Once, when he arrived at a hard-luck hotel and found the landlord had run out of meat and bread, he cheerfully announced, "Well, in the absence of anything to eat, I'll jump into this cabbage." Everywhere on the circuit, Lincoln's services were much in demand, mostly by younger attorneys who needed his assistance in drafting legal papers and in presenting their cases to the court. With some of them, he worked so frequently that they came to think of themselves as his partners, though they should more properly be termed his associates. With only one, Ward Hill Lehman in Danville, was there anything like a formal arrangement. A local newspaper announced in 1852 the formation of the new firm of Lincoln and Lehman, attorneys at law. Possibly Lehman alone was responsible for inserting the advertisement, and perhaps Lincoln never knew of it. Anyway, he never rebuked Laman, because he was fond of this hard-drinking, two-fisted young giant with his endless repertory of off-color stories and Negro songs. The partnership, if it deserved that name, was limited to Vermilion County, where Lincoln and Laman did frequently appear together, Laman leaning heavily on the senior lawyer for guidance. For the most part, Lincoln's cases in the circuit courts continued to be of no great interest or consequence to anyone except the parties involved in the litigation. For instance, at the 1850 session of the Tazewell County Circuit Court, where he always had a large practice, he represented three defendants who were being sued by the village of Tremont for establishing an unwholesome business, a lard factory that was polluting the neighborhood. Lincoln based his case on a highly technical point, involving a statute of limitations, and lost, and his clients were fined $10 each. The next year, he and two local lawyers represented members of the Funk family, accused of cutting 1,200 trees on the property of John Shibley and hauling off the timber. He lost again, but the defeat was a technical one, since the jury awarded the plaintiff only $104. In 1852, he defended Sheriff William Gaither and John Jones, accused of imprisoning and beating one Joseph F. Haynes, on whom they were attempting to serve a writ. The jury acquitted Gaither, but fined his assistant, Jones, $10. Lincoln could consider that half a victory. Later that same year, he represented John P. Singleton, who was sued for non-payment of a debt to Pearly Brown. In fact, Singleton had paid part of the debt and, at a time when cash was scarce in the West, had tried to pay the rest in corn, which Brown refused to accept. Lincoln negotiated a settlement. At the 1855 session, he appeared for one Peter Duffy, accused of having repeatedly beaten, kicked, and thrown to the ground Benjamin Seaman, causing him to be greatly hurt, bruised, and wounded, sore, lame, and disordered. The grand jury found four Seaman, but under Lincoln's persuasion, reduced the damages awarded him from the $300 he claimed to only $3. Lincoln's income from his circuit court practice depended on the volume of the cases he handled. His fees were generally modest, as were those charged by most other attorneys on the circuit. For most cases, he received $10 or $20. Collecting a debt of $600, he retained as his fee only $350. He felt strongly that clients shouldn't be overcharged. In 1856, when a man in Quincy sent him a check for $25 for drawing up some legal papers, Lincoln wrote, "You must think I'm a high-priced man. You're too liberal with your money. $15 is enough for the job." He returned the balance. In handling hundreds of cases in the circuit courts, Lincoln firmly reestablished his reputation as a lawyer. It was a reputation that rested, first, on the universal belief in his absolute honesty. He became known as Honest Abe, or often Honest Old Abe, the lawyer who was never known to lie. He held himself to the highest standards of truthfulness. In notes for a lecture on the law, written about 1850, he referred to the vague popular belief that lawyers are necessarily dishonest, and warned, "Let no young man choosing the law for a calling for a moment yield to this popular belief. Resolve to be honest at all events. And if, in your own judgment, you can't be an honest lawyer, resolve to be honest without being a lawyer. Choose some other occupation. Clients and other attorneys also respected Lincoln's incredible capacity for hard work. Though most of the cases he argued on the circuit originated with local lawyers, he drafted nearly all the legal papers himself, from the purely formal precepies to the most elaborate pleadings. Writing all these out in his own hand sometimes involved enormous labor. In the 1855 Macoupin County case of Clark and Morrison versus Page and Bacon, involving the claims of some St. Louis bankers and financiers, Lincoln, for the defendants, drafted a 43-page answer to the plaintiff's bill of complaints. This was a task that required immense concentration, and Lincoln's handwriting suggested that he wrote the entire document at one sitting. Of course, few cases required so much labor. But Lincoln's clients rarely lost a suit because of carelessness or inattention on the part of their attorney. Lincoln was also noted for his fairness to his opponents. Like any other lawyer, he resorted to technicalities in order to save his clients. But in these circuit court cases, he preferred to base his arguments on justice rather than on legal precedents. His one standard move in the more serious of these cases was to apply for a change of venue, in the belief that the delay in hearing and the transfer of a case to another county would give his clients a fairer trial. In court, he rarely raised objections when opposing counsel introduced evidence. According to Leonard Swett, the young Bloomington lawyer who traveled the circuit with Lincoln, he would say he reckoned it would be fair to let this in or that. And sometimes, when his adversary couldn't quite prove what Lincoln knew to be the truth, he reckoned it would be fair to admit the truth to be so-and-so. But this, Swett noted, didn't mean that he yielded essentials. What he was so blandly giving away was simply what he couldn't get and keep. Many a rival lawyer was lulled into complacency as Lincoln conceded, say, 6 out of 7 points in argument, only to discover that the whole case turned on the 7th point. Any man who took Lincoln for a simple-minded man, Swett concluded, would very soon wake up with his back in a ditch. Rarely did Lincoln object to a judge's ruling on the admissibility of evidence, usually saying when the argument went against him, "Well, I reckon I must be wrong." But when the point was essential to his case, he would vigorously controvert the court's ruling. In a celebrated 1859 case in the Sangamon County Circuit Court, which by this point was no longer part of David Davis's 8th Judicial District, he, Logan, and Shelby M. Cullum represented Peachy Quinn Harrison, accused of stabbing Greek Crafton to death in the vicinity of Pleasant Plains. The stenographic transcript of the trial, the only such transcript for any case in which Lincoln was involved, showed that Lincoln and Logan didn't attempt to deny that Harrison had killed Crafton, but tried to prove that he did so because Crafton had repeatedly threatened to beat him up. The prosecuting attorney argued that evidence of these threats was inadmissible, since it couldn't be proved that Harrison knew about them before the fatal stabbing. The judge, E. Y. Rice, a lifelong Democrat and political opponent of Lincoln, agreed and excluded the evidence. In a second line of defense, Lincoln and his associates attempted to introduce the testimony of Crafton's grandfather, Peter Cartwright. the venerable Methodist exhorter, who had once run against Lincoln for Congress, visited Crafton on his deathbed. Cartwright testified that his grandson had shown remorse for having threatened Harrison and said, "I've brought it upon myself, and I forgive Quinn." Again, the prosecution objected, arguing that Crafton's dying statement was inadmissible and irrelevant, and Judge Rice agreed to exclude Cartwright's testimony. Angrily, Lincoln protested both decisions, saying in court that he had never heard of such law. The trial transcript didn't include his argument against Judge Rice's ruling, but Herndon, who was in the courtroom, vividly remembered that Lincoln denounced it as absurd and without precedent in the broad world. He spoke fiercely, strongly, contemptuously of the decision of the court, just managing to avoid anything that could be held as contempt. Under his withering attack, Judge Rice retracted his ruling and allowed both Cartwright's testimony and the evidence concerning threats to go to the jury, which acquitted Lincoln's client. In his examination of witnesses, a newspaperman wrote of Lincoln in 1850, "He displays a masterly ingenuity and a legal tact that baffles concealment and defies deceit." His legendary skill as a cross-examiner was clearly demonstrated in his most celebrated criminal case, the 1858 trial of William Duff Armstrong for the murder of James Metzger. Attending a religious camp meeting at Virgin's Grove, near the now deserted site of New Salem, in August 1857, Armstrong, Metzger, and James Norris, all undoubtedly drunk, got into a fight, and Metzger was killed. Norris was accused of having hit Metzger on the back of his head with a piece of wood, and Armstrong was indicted for striking him in the eye with his metal slungshot. The two cases were separated, and Norris was convicted for manslaughter. Armstrong's mother, Hannah, asked Lincoln to defend her son. Remembering his long friendship for the young man's father, Jack Armstrong, and Hannah's many kindnesses during his years in New Salem, Lincoln readily agreed. He accepted no fee. At the trial, which was moved to the Cass County Courthouse in Beardstown, the state's principal witness was Charles Allen, who testified that Armstrong struck Metzger. Though it was 11 o'clock at night, and Allen was standing 150 feet away, he claimed that he could see the attack clearly by the light of the nearly full moon shining directly overhead. On cross-examination, Lincoln slowly and with seeming casualness had Allen go through his story a dozen times, asking him to describe just what he had seen and how he was able to see it. Then, with the witness firmly committed to his story, Lincoln produced an 1857 almanac and read from it to show that at the time Allen claimed to have witnessed the attack, the moon had already set. The roar of laughter that followed showed that Allen's credibility was demolished. Lincoln's skill in making the closing argument in a case caused one Illinois journalist to place him at the head of the profession in this state, adding, "Though he may have his equal, it would be no easy task to find his superior." On rare occasions, he ended with a powerful emotional address to the jury. In the Duff Armstrong case, after carefully reviewing the now discredited evidence advanced by the prosecution, he made an unabashedly sentimental appeal that, as the prosecuting attorney remembered, took the jury by storm. He told the jurors of his once being a poor, friendless boy, that Armstrong's father took him into his house, fed and clothed him, and gave him a home. There were tears in his eyes as he spoke, and the story he told with such pathos moved the jury to tears also. His sympathies were fully enlisted in favor of the young man, the prosecutor recalled, and his terrible sincerity couldn't help but arouse the same passion in the jury. Armstrong was acquitted. But that summation was unusual, for Lincoln ordinarily ended with a low-key, logical argument that jurors could readily understand. A reporter discovered no false glitter, no sickly sentimentalism in his arguments. Instead, bold, forcible, and energetic, he forces conviction upon the mind. Davis and some of the attorneys were puzzled that Lincoln, up to 1854, generally remained with the court throughout the circuit without returning home. And sometimes they direly speculated that he must be having marital problems. They failed to realize that the law was Lincoln's only means of support. Unlike Davis, Logan, and a number of other 8th District lawyers, he didn't make a fortune from land speculation, nor did he own a farm or run a business. His law practice brought in a comfortable income of perhaps $2,000 a year, and by 1860 the census taker reported he owned real estate valued at $5,000 and a personal estate of $12,000. To maintain that level, he had to be constantly at work. He stayed throughout the circuit because he couldn't afford to be absent. It was fortunate that he could remain in Springfield for most of the summer months and during the winter, when the Illinois Supreme Court and the United States District Court met in the state capitol, because he was much needed at home to help with a series of family crises. His father, Thomas Lincoln, was in failing health. Since 1840, the elder Lincolns had been living in a double log cabin on a 120-acre farm on Goose Nest Prairie in Coles County. Though Abraham Lincoln had developed an entirely different set of interests and values from those of his father and stepmother, he was concerned for their well-being and tried to help them live in modest comfort. In the 1840s, when Thomas Lincoln got into financial difficulties, probably through partnership with his lazy and unreliable stepson, John D. Johnston, in a saw and grist mill, Abraham Lincoln came to his rescue by paying him $200 for the east 40 acres of his farm, a payment that was really a gift, since the agreement clearly specified that Thomas and Sarah Lincoln were to have use and entire control of the land during their lifetimes. From time to time, when his work on the circuit brought him near Coles County, where he had a certain amount of business, though it was not part of the 8th Judicial District, he would visit his parents. While he was in Congress, Thomas begged him for a loan of $20 to prevent his farm from being sold to settle a long-forgotten judgment against him. Lincoln promptly sent the money, though his letter made it clear that he thought it was singular that his father couldn't pay such a small debt and that such an obligation could have been forgotten for so long. In all probability, he suspected Johnston of making up the whole story. Toward his stepmother, Lincoln always had the most affectionate feelings, and he closed his letter, "Give my love to mother." Toward his father, his attitude was more ambivalent. The two had never been close, and they'd drifted apart even more since Abraham left home. Thomas Lincoln's unambitious, unsuccessful way of life came to represent the values his son wanted to repudiate. He had reason, too, to believe that his father, as he reached 70, was becoming a little senile and was too much under the influence of the unreliable Johnston. In May 1849, shortly after Lincoln returned from Washington, he heard from Johnston that Thomas Lincoln was dying. "He craves to see you all the time," the stepbrother wrote, "and he wants you to come if you are able to get here, for you are his only child that is of his own flesh and blood, and it is nothing more than nature for him to crave to see you." At Johnston's request, Augustus H. Chapman, Dennis Hanks' son-in-law, reinforced the plea with a letter describing Thomas Lincoln's seizure of the heart and his truly heart-rending cries to see his only son. Though Lincoln at this point was actively campaigning to secure appointment as commissioner of the General Land Office, he rushed off to Coles County to see his father, probably missing a second letter from Chapman assuring him that Thomas Lincoln had no heart disease and would doubtless be well in a short time. Lincoln's visit to Goose Nest Prairie delayed by nearly a week his trip to Washington, and it may have cost him the land office appointment. The next winter, when John D. Johnston wrote him two more letters about Thomas Lincoln's declining health, Abraham Lincoln didn't respond. He thought his stepbrother was again crying wolf. Only after he heard independently from Harriet Chapman did he take the news seriously. Repeating his desire that neither father or mother shall be in want of any comfort, either in health or sickness, he explained why he couldn't come to his father's sickbed. "My business is such that I could hardly leave home now," he wrote. "Besides, his wife was sick abed with baby sickness." Both excuses had some plausibility. A trip by buggy to Coles County would take 3 days each way, at a time when Lincoln had cases before the United States Circuit and District Courts and the Illinois Supreme Court almost every day. But had he truly wanted to go, he could have entrusted his cases to his partner or asked for postponements. It was also true that Mary had given birth to their third son on December 21st. Though the delivery was perfectly normal, she doubtless would have been highly nervous if Lincoln left home while she had the entire responsibility of caring for a newborn baby. But again, her illness wasn't serious, and there were friends and neighbors who could help her. Once again, the husband allowed his wife to take the blame for an uncomfortable decision. The rest of Lincoln's letter, urging his father to call upon and confide in our great and good and merciful Maker, who notes the fall of a sparrow and numbers the hairs of our heads, was in unconvincing and strained language, rarely addressed to his backwoods relatives who thought in the clichés of the primitive Baptists. "Say to him," he enjoined Johnston, "that if we could meet now, it's doubtful whether it wouldn't be more painful than pleasant. But that if it be his lot to go now, he'll soon have a joyous meeting with many loved ones gone before, and where the rest of us, through the help of God, hope ere long to join them." Unable to simulate a grief that he didn't feel, or an affection that he didn't bear, Lincoln didn't attend his father's funeral. He wasn't heartless, but Thomas Lincoln represented a world that his son had long ago left behind him. During the years of his father's final illness, Lincoln had also to deal with family crises closer to home. In December 1849, his son Edward Baker, always a feeble child, became seriously sick. His disease was pulmonary tuberculosis, for which there was no known cure. After 52 days of acute illness, the little boy, who wasn't quite 4 years old, died on February 1st, 1850. Both parents were devastated. Lincoln, as always, internalized his emotions, saying only, "We miss him very much." For his wife, Eddie's death coming shortly after the deaths of both her father and her beloved grandmother was harder to bear, especially since she was exhausted from the long vigil of nursing the sick child. Like her husband, she lacked faith in conventional Christianity, and consequently was denied the consolation of believing that her son's death was all for the best, as part of some divine plan. Restlessly, she kicked against the pricks of fate. And more than 2 years after Eddie's death, she wrote a Kentucky friend, "I grieve to say that even at this distant day, I do not feel sufficiently submissive to our loss." A few weeks after Eddie's death, she was expecting again. The Lincolns clearly intended to replace the lost boy. Her pregnancy was uneventful, but once again she was alone much of the time, since Lincoln was away on the circuit. The baby was named William Wallace Lincoln, after her physician brother-in-law, who'd been so helpful during Eddie's final days. Willie was the most intelligent and the best-looking of all the Lincoln children, and from the day he was born, his father doted on him. Then, because Willie needed a playmate, Mary, in 1853, gave birth to a fourth child. The Lincolns had hoped this time for a girl, but they were soon reconciled to accepting another boy, whom they named Thomas, after his recently deceased grandfather. The choice of the name suggested that Abraham Lincoln's memories of his father were not all unpleasant, and perhaps it hinted at guilt for not having attended his funeral. The infant was born with an unusually large head as compared to his tiny body, and Lincoln playfully called him a little tadpole. The nickname, Tad, stuck to him for the rest of his life. The careful 2.5-year intervals between the births of the Lincoln children suggested that the parents were using some form of birth control. Doubtless they relied in part on the widespread belief that conception couldn't take place so long as the mother was nursing, for Mary Lincoln didn't wean her babies until after they were 18 months old. After the birth of Tad, it may have been impossible for her to have additional children. The delivery had been difficult, perhaps because of the size of the infant's head, and it left Mary for the rest of her life as more or less a sufferer from what she called, with Victorian propriety, troubles of a womanly nature. By the mid-1850s, the nature of Lincoln's law practice was gradually changing. He continued to have numerous cases with small fees and less consequence, but increasingly his time was taken up with suits relating to the railroad network that began to spread across the state. Wherever railroads ran, there were legal problems. Problems concerning charters and franchises, problems relating to right-of-way, problems concerning evaluation and taxation, problems relating to the duties of common carriers and the rights of passengers, problems concerning merger, consolidation, and receivership. And Lincoln, like other lawyers, found the ensuing litigation a major source of income. Long an advocate of improved transportation as the key to economic development, Lincoln took on his first significant railroad case in 1851 for the Alton and Sangamon Railroad, which he considered a link in the great chain of railroad communication which shall unite Boston and New York with the Mississippi. The suit arose when one of the original subscribers to the stock of the railroad, James A. Barrett, who owned land in western Sangamon County, refused to pay the balance due on his pledge in order to protest a change in the planned route of the road. When he'd subscribe for his 30 shares, it was to go by his 4,215 acres, which consequently would greatly increase in value. But a shift in the route, designed to cut off 12 miles in the length of the road, meant that he would derive no direct benefit from the construction. Employing Lincoln, the railroad sued for payment of Barrett's pledge. Everyone realized the case was important because, as Lincoln said, if Barrett won, it might encourage others to stop payments on their subscriptions. Lincoln took extraordinary pains to construct an airtight case for his client, designed to prove that Barrett was indeed a stockholder and that the Alton and Sangamon Railroad had the right to sue for his delinquent payment. In frequent correspondence with officials of the railroad, both in New York and in Alton, Lincoln insisted that they provide full documentation to support his brief, noting, "I've labored hard to find the law that applied to cases like this." The Illinois Supreme Court accepted his argument, and Chief Justice Samuel Treat agreed that a few obstinate stockholders should not be permitted to deprive the public and the company of the advantages that will result from a superior and less expensive route. The decision, subsequently cited in 25 other cases throughout the United States, helped establish the principle that corporation charters could be amended in the public interest, and it established Lincoln as one of the most prominent and successful Illinois practitioners of railroad law.
This ends Disc 8.